Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the 14th video of the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we'll look at the book of Leviticus using the standard categories of background, organization, content, and theological themes. First, the background. As you may recall, Leviticus is the third book of the Torah, which is also called the Pentateuch or the Five Books of Moses. It is the continuing story of the founding of God's people Israel from the descendants of Abraham into a covenant relationship with God after he had rescued them from Egypt and revealed himself and his righteous standards. And that is where we pick up with Leviticus. It starts right where Exodus ends. In fact, Leviticus is basically a continuation of the instructions about the proper worship of God that were begun in Exodus. The name of this book is Leviticus, and Leviticus is a Greek word which means pertaining to Levites. Levites were the descendants of Levi, one of Jacob's 12 sons. All the priests and tabernacle workers were Levites. Moses and his brother Aaron were Levites, and Aaron was the first high priest, and all the priests were descended from him. So this book is about the activities of the priests and workers in the tabernacle, describing their functions and actions, and how these things matter for all the people of God. Now, the Hebrew title for this book comes from the book's very first words, which are, "And he called." Notice that the book starts with the word "and," which is an unusual word at the very beginning of any book. And that means, grammatically, Leviticus continues from Exodus without missing a beat, because it is the third part of a unified whole. We cannot understand Leviticus except as part three of the five-volume Torah. Therefore, the authorship and time of Leviticus are the same for the rest of the Pentateuch. It was written by Moses just after the time of these events at the Exodus from Egypt. But in terms of the history described in this book, Leviticus is like a freeze frame in the historical narrative. In other words, Leviticus is not narrative. It's not story. It does not tell events that happened. The story that we saw in the books of Genesis continuing into Exodus, that story is paused because their travels stopped at Mount Sinai to receive revelation from God. And the story will start again in the next book of Numbers. The story is paused at Leviticus because Leviticus is a different kind of testimony from Israel's history. Leviticus is part of the direct revelation received from God at Sinai. It is primarily laws and instructions about religious life in the ancient Israelite community. All these instructions were given by God and applied while the people were still camped at the base of Mount Sinai, where they remained throughout Leviticus. Therefore, in terms of the purpose of this book, Leviticus continues to address the same question from the end of Exodus: how can a holy God live with an unholy people? The last part of the book of Exodus told where worship would happen by describing the tabernacle. The book of Leviticus then tells how worship will happen. Exodus gave a lot of detail about the construction and furniture of the tabernacle, but it did not really describe what happened in the tabernacle. That is covered in Leviticus. This book gives the divinely inspired and approved manner in which God should be worshiped by Israel. Now, when discussing the nature of this book, I need to acknowledge that Leviticus is a notoriously difficult book. It is the graveyard of well-intentioned Bible reading plans, where people read through Genesis with no problem, Exodus just fine, but then they lose interest in Leviticus because it seems so strange and repetitive, and they don't understand the significance of this book. Now, I hope that this course will help you to overcome that unfamiliarity and help you see the point of Leviticus, and then be able to understand and apply it in your own life. Now, let's look at the organization of Leviticus. The outline of this book is organized around two goals, two things that will happen if these instructions are followed. The first goal is right worship, that is, proper worship that honors and pleases God. This section concentrates on what takes place inside the tabernacle, and this primarily addresses the activities of God's people, particularly the Levites, directed toward God. And the second goal is right living. This is holy living that honors and pleases God. And the focus of this section is what takes place outside the tabernacle in everyday life. And this addresses the activities of God's people toward one another, toward creation, and toward themselves, all in light of God's character and revelation. And the second section is sometimes called the holiness code, because as we'll see, the emphasis on this section is on holiness. And then the first section can be broken down into four subdivisions. The first describes acceptable sacrifices. The second describes an acceptable priesthood. The third, acceptable worshipers. And the last describes the Day of Atonement. We'll just summarize the contents of each of these sections in a moment. But first, let's get a sense of the content by looking at a few key verses. First is Leviticus 11, 44 and 45, which says, "I am Yahweh your God. Consecrate yourselves and be holy, because I am holy. Do not make yourselves unclean by any creature that moves about on the ground. I am Yahweh who brought you up out of Egypt to be your God. Therefore, be holy, because I am holy." This passage demonstrates the key idea of holiness. God required that his people be holy. Now, we talked about the idea of holiness in an earlier section. It is being devoted to God, which entails being separate from the common and unclean, being pure and morally upright. And in this passage, the connection is emphasized between God's holiness and the holiness he demands from his people. Next is Leviticus 16, 9 through 10, which commands, "Aaron shall bring the goat whose lot falls to the Lord and sacrifice it for a sin offering. But the goat chosen by lot as the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to be used for making atonement by sending it into the desert as a scapegoat." This passage is part of the ceremony for the Day of Atonement. And the word translated atonement is related to the idea of covering. An atonement is what is done by God's direction to cover or somehow remove our sins and their consequences from before God. Now, of course, God still knows about them because he knows everything, but atonement makes a way for God not to hold them against us. Like someone might say, it's covered if he pays your debt. Now, on the Day of Atonement, as part of the God-given ceremony to make atonement for the people, one goat was sacrificed to make atonement by blood sacrifice, and the other, called the scapegoat, was sent away, symbolizing the sins of the people being removed far away, signifying the reality of forgiveness and the effectiveness of atonement. Because of the atonement God had provided, the sins are gone. Then later in the same chapter, Leviticus 16, 15, and 16 says, "He shall then slaughter the goat for the sin offering for the people and take its blood behind the curtain and do with it as he did with the bull's blood. He shall sprinkle it on the atonement cover and in front of it. In this way, he will make atonement for the most holy place because of the uncleanness and rebellion of the Israelites, whatever their sins have been. He is to do the same for the tent of meeting, which is among them in the midst of their uncleanness." This passage continues the instructions for the Day of Atonement. It describes the high priest entering the most holy place, which he only did on the Day of Atonement. And it says that he makes atonement for the most holy place. Even the place of God's presence needs to be atoned for with blood sacrifice. Not that God's presence makes it unclean, but because the proximity of the uncleanness and rebellion of the people to God's holiness. This uncleanness of the people made the need for atonement. Then Leviticus 17, 11, and 12 says, "For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Therefore, I say to the Israelites, none of you may eat blood, nor may an alien living among you eat blood." This passage tells us of the nature of the atonement and the necessity for shedding of blood. Life for life, because the penalty of sin is death. Life is taken and blood is shed in order for atonement to happen. This is the thing God has given in order to make atonement. And therefore, blood and life shall be considered sacred by God's people. And finally, Leviticus 19:2 says, "Speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, 'Be holy, because I, Yahweh your God, am holy.'" And this repeats the idea from earlier and emphasizes holiness, which is still a central idea of Leviticus. All right, these are the key verses from Leviticus. Now, let's look at the content of each section. We won't go into the level of detail which we did for Genesis and Exodus, but I hope you'll get a summary of the contents and understand the book as a whole, which will prepare you for further study. The first section teaches about right worship, how to worship rightly. It teaches about five types of sacrifices that are acceptable to God. There are five general types of offerings commanded in Leviticus, and the purpose for them is also given, as I'll highlight. First is the burnt offering. In this sacrifice, an animal is slaughtered and its entire carcass is burned up, giving it completely to God. This sacrifice acknowledges God's complete ownership and his due as Lord over his people. Next is the cereal offering, also called the grain offering. This is basically the same as the burnt offering, except it consists of grain instead of an animal. It is entirely consumed by the fire and wholly given to God. And the third is the peace offering, sometimes called the fellowship offering. This is a voluntary offering given just to say, in essence, "I appreciate the Lord. I honor the Lord as my King and my God by giving him something precious to me." Part of this offering was burned, part was given to the priests, and part was eaten by the one who offered it and by his family. It was like eating a family meal in the presence of God as a way to strengthen the fellowship and relationship with God by showing him honor and eating a meal in his presence. And there is a summary purpose statement that is repeated with each of these first three offerings. This phrase says, "It is an offering by fire, a pleasing aroma to the Lord." This shows that each of these offerings was seen as strengthening the connection between people and God by giving him honor, and this was somehow pleasing to the Lord. The fourth type of offering is called the sin offering. These are required for specific sins that a person might commit. Whenever a person committed a sin, they were to offer a specific sacrifice according to the regulations explained in Leviticus. And the fifth is the guilt offering. These are required for general guilt, not for specific sins, but for the guilt of conscious and unconscious sin in general. And these last two types of sacrifice also have a summary purpose statement, which is, "The priest shall make atonement on his behalf for his sin, and he shall be forgiven." This repeated refrain proclaims that when these offerings are made, the people are assured that their sin is effectively dealt with, because God himself has commanded these sacrifices, and he has promised that because of these sacrifices, their sin would be forgiven. Then the next portion of Leviticus talks about acceptable priesthood. In chapter 8, Aaron and his sons are consecrated as priests. In chapter 9, they begin their priestly work. They offer sacrifices which are accepted by God. Then, by way of contrast, in chapter 10, two of Aaron's sons offered sacrifices which were not accepted by God. We're told that they offered unauthorized sacrifices which were contrary to what God had commanded them. They made sacrifices on their own initiative and decision and not in obedience to God's command. And as a result, they were killed by God. This sends the clear message that we must worship God's way. He makes the rules, not us. We need to beware of pushing creativity and innovation too far when it comes to worship, because there is a point where it becomes unacceptable to God if we stray from his revealed manner of worship. Make sure your worship activities and practices are formed more by God's revelation than by our culture or by people's personal preferences, even your own. And the reason given in this chapter why they were killed is that God will show himself to be holy among his people, and he insists that he will be honored by those who approach him in worship. Then Leviticus goes on to describe acceptable worshipers. And this section highlights the idea of clean and unclean. This concept may seem foreign to us, so let me try to help with two illustrations. First, imagine if the president or the Queen of England or somebody famous or really special to you was going to visit your place. You would probably clean up, wouldn't you? You would put away your dirty socks and wash your dirty dishes. You would want everything to be right and perfect, and you would probably be very picky to not allow anything stained or disgusting to be there. And if you would refuse to clean up in this way, the uncleanness of your house would be taken as offensive for two reasons. First is that your dirty socks really are disgusting. And second, that you did not care enough about your visitor to deal with these things before your visitor arrived. Now, how much more should God be offended by vileness and uncleanness when he is present among his people? And in this larger section, he is the one who decides and reveals what is actually unclean in his sight. And for the second explanation of this concept, remember the distinction between the holy and the common. God makes a distinction between what is holy and pure by being set apart for him, and what is common and therefore unclean. The world is stained by sin and decay, but God is completely holy and pure, and a sharp distinction is made between the two. And he wants his people to be on the side of purity and holiness, not on the side of uncleanness and contamination. Now, these are imperfect illustrations, and there's also an aspect of hygiene and protection for God's people in all these commands. But I hope these things will help you see why God takes the concept of clean and unclean seriously. And these chapters not only teach about what is clean and what is unclean, they also teach how to have cleanliness in those specific issues so as to honor and avoid offending God. Chapter 11 describes clean and unclean food. Chapter 12 talks about childbirth. Chapters 13 and 14 address fungus and skin disease, and chapter 15 gives regulations about various bodily discharges. And this whole section climaxes with the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement is one of the central ideas of Leviticus, and it was one of the most important days of the Israelite calendar. On this day, the people would abstain from all food. Sacrifices were offered to atone for everything. Every part of the tabernacle was atoned for by sprinkling with blood, and sacrifice was made for every part of Israelite life. The high priest entered the most holy place, and he splashed blood on the atonement cover of the Ark of the Covenant. This is the only time of year he entered the most holy place. And the scapegoat symbolically took the sin of the people away outside the camp. One animal was killed, and one animal was sent away, and they both symbolically took away sins. And the result of the Day of Atonement, stated in 1630, was that all would be clean. All of this so far was God's instructions about how he was to be worshipped rightly by his people in the desert. Then the second major section of Leviticus teaches about right living, how to live rightly in every area of life. This section is often called the Holiness Code because the word holy is used many times. And the result of people following these laws in that culture is that they would be holy. That was one overall reason given for obeying these laws, to be set apart to the Lord as holy. Now, there's a variety of laws covered in this section, including such things as moral laws, Sabbath laws, vows and tithes, and many others, covering all parts of Israelite life. And all these laws are based in some way on God's character, so that in following these laws and being holy, his people were somehow imitating and conforming to his character. Remember the important command repeated in this section, "Be holy because I am holy." And then the other major reason given in Leviticus for obeying all these laws is, quote, "I am Yahweh." Again, This is an appeal to God's character and to his lordship and to the kind of God that he is, and that he is to be taken very seriously based on his revelation of his nature and character that they saw in the Exodus from Egypt and in the giving of the covenant at Sinai. Now, let me give you one example of this connection as it relates to a controversial topic. Chapter 18 of Leviticus gives specific rules about sex, with whom people may engage in sex and with whom they may not. But look carefully at how this chapter begins. Before it gives any rules, in verses 1 through 5, God says, "I am Yahweh your God. Don't do like the other nations do, but you must follow my laws and rules. I am Yahweh. Keep my rules and you will live. I am Yahweh." Before it said anything about what was acceptable and unacceptable behavior, it stressed who God is and why he has the authority to command his people in this area of life. You see, he's Lord and he makes the rules, and his people must be holy, conforming to his character. Now, we also know that he is gracious and wise, and the rules he makes are for our benefit and protection, but we cannot ever compromise the fact that he is the one who has the right to determine right and wrong, and we do not. Neither our surrounding culture, nor our courts, nor anyone but God has the authority to make these kinds of decisions. Only our God is Lord. He's not like the gods of Egypt that can be bartered with or manipulated or ignored. He is the creator and ruler of the universe. Therefore, in our culture, whenever these issues are discussed, instead of just debating this is right, this is wrong, which we should continue to do, we can also raise the more fundamental question of who really has the right to make these decisions and why. Because that question gets to the heart of the issue and the real point of disagreement in our culture. Who decides what is right and wrong? Now, that's just one example of the many ways that Leviticus is helpful and relevant, not only for the people in the days of Moses, but for us as well, because it not only talks about specific behaviors and rituals, it also connects everything to God and his character and his purposes. And it trains us to think in similar ways. Now, another part of the Holiness Code I need to mention is the religious festivals it describes. There are 7 regular festivals covered in Leviticus. It mentions the weekly Sabbath observance, and it reminds of the celebration of the Passover on every anniversary of that event. It describes the yearly Day of Atonement and other yearly celebrations, each of which has some memorial and religious significance, remembering and celebrating what God has done for his people. And Leviticus makes provisions for the forgiveness of debts and rest on the Sabbath and Jubilee years. And finally, Leviticus also contains many promises of rewards for obedience to God and his commands, alongside with strong warnings of punishment for disobedience and unholiness. God made very clear that he was earnest about these things, and he expected his people to take them all very seriously. This, then, is a brief survey of the content of the book of Leviticus. Now let's look at the theological themes. The first theme is priesthood. In Leviticus, continuing from what was taught in Exodus, we learn that certain people were set aside as priests. Only those chosen and designated by God could be priests. And in ancient Israel, these were the male descendants of Aaron. And the rest of the Levites also served a secondary priestly function. Now, the main purpose and function of priesthood was to be a mediator between God and the rest of the people. As a go-between, a priest represented God to the people. The priests and Levites were responsible to teach the people the laws and instructions from God and make judgments whenever people had questions or disputes. And the priests also represented the people toward God, primarily by offering sacrifices and making atonement on their behalf in the tabernacle. Remember that the tabernacle was the place for God's presence among his people, both present with them and separated. And the priests were the connection, mediating God's presence to the people and the people's sacrifices to God. And in the New Testament, we are taught that Jesus fulfilled all the functions of the priesthood, and therefore we no longer need human intermediaries because we all have access directly to God in Christ. Then the second theme is holiness. God's people must be separate, not common. Israel must be different from the surrounding nations. God's people must stand out as different from people who don't know God. We need to live in a way that demonstrates cleanness and holiness and God's character and greatness. We need to be set apart for God, to be like God in moral purity, because God himself is holy, and he is our moral standard. The third theme is atonement by sacrifice. We've seen the Day of Atonement. We've seen the five types of sacrifices. In Leviticus, we learn that God has graciously given a substitute of blood, one life given instead of the life of the sinner. And this substitute sacrifice covers the sin and brings forgiveness. Atonement is the covering of sin. And when a sin is atoned through authorized sacrifice, God no longer holds it against them. Sacrifice is the means of atonement and forgiveness of sins. And the final theme is festivals. We were barely able to touch on this, but it is an important idea in this book. There are certain times every year when God's people celebrated and dedicated time for God in community with all Israel. This is the original idea of a holiday. It is a holy day. These are times set aside for fellowship with God. And many of the sacrifices described in this book happened as a part of their regular festival days. And the specific festivals required for ancient Israel were described in Leviticus. All right, those are the theological themes of this book. So now, let's review. The organization of Leviticus is around the two goals of its instruction. These are right worship and right living. And the theological themes of Leviticus are priesthood, holiness, atonement, and festivals. You can use the acronym FAF if that helps you remember these themes, or if you just like saying FAF. I hope this all gives you a new appreciation for the book of Leviticus. Yes, it can be a difficult book because it is so foreign to us, but it is actually a very influential book, especially for the New Testament understanding of sacrifice and atonement, and therefore it helps explain the cross of Christ. And the New Testament book of Hebrews is basically an exposition of the ideas contained in Leviticus. So I hope you're encouraged to explore Leviticus a bit more. Now in the next section, we'll look at the book of Numbers. And I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for watching.